you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is the Chris and Amy Show on 104.1 FM KMOX, and the last time we checked in on the International Festival, the Festival of Nations, which takes place because of the International Institute of St. Louis, that was a few months ago, and they were concerned about whether or not the Festival of Nations would go on as planned. It is going to, August 23rd and 24th. And to discuss it with us, Blake Hamilton is the interim CEO of the International Institute of St. Louis, with us now in studio. How you doing, Blake?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
So congratulations, first of all, on getting this done, that it's going to happen. With the uncertainty from weeks and weeks ago, how do we get to the point where we now know it's going to go on?
Well, we're really able to do this event every year because of the number of volunteers and the amount of community support. And this year, that really, we've seen folks step up in incredible ways. And once, I think, a lot of folks in the community who really value the festival really saw that this was a really at risk of not happening, that they really wanted to show their support. And we're thankful that they did. And, you know, we're really happy to have a large number of sponsors who really stepped up early to help ensure that this festival can continue to go on.
Was the primary reason that the Festival of Nations was in limbo because of the federal cuts to the staff at the federal cuts to funding and thus the staff at International Institute?
Well, certainly. Delays in receiving funding really put us in a critical position when it came to our available cash. And of course, our primary focus is the services that we provide to refugees and immigrants, the opportunities that we create for folks to thrive. And that is our mission. And so we didn't want to distract from our mission and knew that the cash reserves that we had needed to be devoted to service and really cause us to think, well, you know, the festival is really a great resource for the region, but we have to really focus on our core mission. But, you know, due to some of those funds being reimbursed to us and what we were owed by the federal government kind of coming in over the course of the last few months, really it's put us in a much better position. And again, with sponsors and folks stepping up saying that they want to see this happen, folks volunteering to assist with organizing and putting it on, you know, we're being given the capacity and support in the way that makes us comfortable being able to move forward with it. We're really happy to do so.
So when you only have so many resources, you can't do everything. You said your primary focus or your primary mission you wanted to focus on, weren't sure you can do the festival this year. Was that interrupted in any way? Your main duties as an organization, how much was that interrupted, if at all?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, again, not having access to the funds that enable us to provide the services that are really important. Connecting people to employment, getting kids enrolled in school, providing health and wellness support to families. All of those are really at the center of what we do, providing education. And those programs and services were certainly at threat with not having the funding that was really dedicated to performing that. We invested our own resources in ensuring that those could continue and get us through until we did start to see federal funding again. But we had to necessarily scale back. You mentioned we had to engage in furloughs, and that was really challenging for us as an organization to know what we can do and then suddenly not have the resources to be able to do it. We did see federal funding cuts to programs such as refugee resettlement, which is still not back online. We've seen cuts to our citizenship program, which provided classroom education for refugees and anybody who's on the path to citizenship to learn about civics. I always say, you know, who is most capable of passing the citizenship test? It's really like a fifth grader who's just taken a civics course, right? It is that information that is about our democracy and how this country operates in our history that is critical to being able to pass that test. And we had received for nearly 20 years funding to provide that sort of education to immigrants and refugees who are on that path. And that funding was terminated. We were very thankful that we had volunteers who had been connected to that program for nearly a decade, who came to us and said, we understand that there's no funding for this program, but we feel like we're capable of seeing it through with this cohort. And it's really that sort of dedication and commitment from the community that really enables us to march forward with our services. And that same type of commitment is helping us ensure that we do have a Festival of Nations this year.
I know there's a lot of confusion regarding the United States and how welcoming it is to immigrants right now. But let's focus on St. Louis and the perception. Is St. Louis, among the community of immigrants who are finding a place to make their new home, is it more St. Louis is a dangerous city with high crime rates, or is it St. Louis is a great place for immigrants? Where are we with that?
St. Louis has a reputation for being very welcoming. I mean, there's a number of amenities and resources. It isn't just the International Institute, but many others that are serving immigrants. And we have the Office of New Americans here in the city and very welcoming policies that really support immigrant business development as well. And those are all key factors in attracting folks to our region. Of course, the region isn't without its challenges and its reputation that causes pause to some. But those who come here and are able to establish themselves and their families and find a safe place and a place where they can get a job that makes ends meet and helps their families thrive, that's the story that folks tell. And when that gets into communities, people see that it's a real opportunity. It's not just something that's advertised, but something that people are living and experiencing and taking advantage of that they too could take advantage of in this environment.
And St. Louis is an area, a region that we know loses population, mm-hmm. whether it's in the city limits or even outside the city. So attracting people to come here, I think, should be a goal for all of us. It is when you are trying to welcome people in, is that part of the pitch that, look, St. Louis could use you? We could be, you know, you could help us. We can help you. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yes. I mean, we talk about housing and cost of living and the advantages that St. Louis has compared to major immigration hubs on either coast. St. Louis has a competitive advantage economically to be able to make that American dream more attainable with our low cost of living and ample housing available. And that is something that the city and the region at large greatly benefits from. This is an increase in tax base, an increase in workers. When we see a declining population, it's not just overall numbers, but it's an aging population as well. Immigrants are disproportionately young and of working age and able to fill open positions that are chronically open. We work with, last year we worked with more than 130 employers that put nearly 400 folks to work. And these opportunities that this region has are ones that are very appealing for immigrants who are looking to restart their lives. And the pitch is, you know, what they can have by coming here and the opportunities that mm-hmm. exist, but also it's about being part of something and rebuilding this region. And people have an interest in being a part of something, and they see that there are things worth investing in here in St. Louis.
Yeah, I feel like we have so much more room for immigrants to come here and help grow the community for sure. Well, in that national uncertainty now, when we're looking at the global perception of the United States and the Trump administration crackdown on illegal immigration and how that's leaked over to immigrants who are here legally, who do have visas, and how due process is being questioned here. How have you seen that affect immigrants who are in our area legally, in the St. Louis bi-state area legally?
It creates a tremendous amount of fear and apprehension. Folks, regardless of presence, know that they could be just a traffic stop away from being caught up in proceedings and immense court costs and fees that could be life-changing for them and separate them from their families. And in fact, we have our own immigration services at the International Institute, including an immigration attorney who is representing several cases of individuals who were here, admitted legally, had a legal presence in the United States, and have been caught up in this enforcement acts that have been taking place, and themselves have been separated from their families mm-hmm. and working very hard to try to get those families reunified. What has been created, it really creates a lot of fear for everybody. And when that fear exists, it makes people reticent to send their kids to school, to mm-hmm. Access services like those available at the International Institute that can help with things like employment, things like accessing healthcare or mental health services. And when people don't access services they need, our region at large is less healthy. It's less safe because we have so many people who are afraid to access services and access resources that they're entitled to. Obviously the threat of being separated from one's family, the threat of being erroneously deported is real. And it's something that impacts people's daily lives.
And just as a quick clarification, if a listener is going, well, if you have your visa, why are you nervous? Well, that's the thing. Let's say you are here legally, you have your visa, and something as little as a fender bender that puts you in contact with law enforcement, if they decide it doesn't matter that you're here legally, we're moving forward, we're going to separate you without that due process. How could you not live in fear? To think a speeding ticket, anything.
Any of us would.
Yeah.
Any of us.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely understandable. We have, an environment here that is really threatening to mm-hmm. individuals. And again, you could just be caught in the wrong place at the wrong time and be subject to this. But there are organizations like the Institute, like the MICA Project, like Monarch, and many other service providers within the Immigrant Service Provider Network here in St. Louis that are here to support these individuals. There are far more cases like this than really we have the capacity to support as a region in terms of providing legal assistance. But we ask that anyone who needs that assistance have access to it. And so when we talk about things like changing the system to more expedite more deportations, that is a threat to the legal system. That's a threat to the way that we have always operated as a country, and it puts an incredible fear inside of all of us. It really should, because these folks who are here legally present, just like you and me, could be deported just like you and me, and that's a real big challenge. I often ask people, I say, well, if you got stopped, how would you prove that you're a citizen?
Mm-hmm.
That's a fair question.
It's not something that is easily handled, but
yeah.
we're very thankful for the many resources that this region has to support the individuals who really need it this time. But we always need more folks interested in supporting in many ways. The Festival of Nations, for example, always relies on volunteers. But as an organization writ large, we rely on volunteers and supporters to help us do what we do every day.
Festival of Nations will happen August 23rd and 24th at Tower Grove Park here in St. Louis because of the International Institute of St. Louis. Blake Hamilton, we appreciate you coming in. Best of luck in moving forward, and we're very glad that this is going to go on as planned. So thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That is Blake Hamilton, the interim CEO with the International Institute of St. Louis. It's Chris and Amy on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Do you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, if you recall, it wasn't that long ago, within the last several weeks, that President Trump had a conversation with Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred, and it is thought that the former president, or the current president, had told Manfred that Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. And we know that Pete has been banned from the Hall of Fame because he bet on baseball, which is an absolute no-no in sports. But he did it anyway. And now, as of last night, the commissioner released a statement. And the statement says that Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson, who was part of the Black Sox scandal in 1919, when 8 players presumably took money to throw the World Series, so that all these players now are eligible for the Hall of Fame because their bans are eliminated once they die. So mm-hmm. once the players have died, they are now removed from the ineligible list. So now Shoeless Joe and Pete Rose, two of the most famous people who have been left out of the Hall of Fame for gambling,
are now eligible for it. I think Shoeless Joe should be in. That's a different thing. Pete Rose.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I know people think he paid his debt. And what's the big deal? He never bet on his team to lose, which I don't know if we know that for certain. But what we do know is that he bet prolifically on the Cincinnati Reds when he was player manager. We know he did that. And just giving him the benefit of the doubt that he never bet against his own team, that's not the problem. The problem is the nights that he didn't bet for them, because you're signaling to bookies that you don't think you can win that night. That's still a problem. And it is the one infraction in sports, I think, that a sport cannot overcome. Fine, you've got guys taking HGH and hitting monster home runs. Great. Okay, I know some people don't like it. I don't care about it that much. But if the fan watching a game every night isn't quite sure that the players aren't throwing the game or don't have money on the game, that will absolutely kill a sport.
Yeah, because your argument, rightly so, is that the one infraction, the one sin you cannot commit is compromising the integrity of the competition because
that's correct.
It's over. It's just, it ruins the game. You can't come back from it. I get that. And I do want to get back to Pete Rose as well. But why is it different? Why is Shoeless Joe different than Pete Rose if both were betting / gambling scandals?
So Shoeless Joe, in the World Series that he was supposed to throw, hit like 375. He had a big play in the outfield. He threw a guy out at home. There's no indication that he played poorly on purpose. That's number one. Number two, people who know more about it, and historians have said that he was illiterate and really didn't quite understand the concept of the conspiracy of what was supposed to be going on. He was just owed back pay from Charlie Comiskey, who was one of the cheapest owners in the history of any sport. Just a terrible guy. And he was owed something like, I don't know, $5,000 or maybe more than that. And he wanted his back pay. So he thought he was going to get it somewhere else. But there's no indication he actually ever did anything to... We pretty much know that he took the money, which sounds disqualifying. But it also sounds like, because he was illiterate, maybe not the brightest guy, didn't really know what was going on. Pete Rose knew full well what he was. He had a bookie. You don't just get a bookie thrown at you. You seek out a bookie. You seek out people that you can place bets when betting is illegal.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly what he was doing.
So
I have no sympathy for Pete Rose. And I know that there are people out there that say the man paid his debt, let him in. Now, well, I mean, he's dead now, but I don't know. Screw Pete Rose.
So if this new rule is once you're dead, your sins are forgiven, and you can go to the Hall of Fame, would that automatically mean that when Mark McGwire and all these performance-enhancing
Barry Bonds,
drug guys die, then you get to put them in?
Yeah. Yeah, and I this may sound hypocritical. I don't think it does, but I understand why you might think it sounds that way. The HGH, the steroid guys, I don't look at them the same way I look at gamblers. I don't look at them the same way I look at people who threaten the integrity of the competition. And what I mean is, you cannot have a sport where people watching it aren't quite sure if the player on the field is throwing the game, making an error on purpose, throwing a wild pitch, because they've got money on the side. It's unsurvivable. It's one thing if you're cheating to try and hit more home runs or to stay on the field and to recover quicker from injury. That's one thing. But if people watching think that you're not trying your hardest because you might have money coming in if you don't try your hardest, that's the kind of thing that will end a sport.
So here's a statement from Christopher Scalia, the son of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, Christopher Scalia wants Pete Rose in. We'd love to get him on, talk about why he wants Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. However, this statement, I want to get your thoughts on it. Here's what he said. There's a case to be made that it is hypocritical for a league now in cahoots with a sports book, as is Major League Baseball, to ban someone for betting. On the other hand, the league may reason that its embrace of legalized sports gambling makes it all the more important to mark a clear boundary between the habits of fans and the vices of league employees. And I agree. Like I said, that's not about Pete Rose itself. It's when people bring up, well, what about Major League Baseball, you know, now having sports books? Christopher Scalia is saying, yeah, but that actually almost makes the boundary line that much more important. If you're going to have Major League Baseball and sports books in cahoots, you got to make sure there's a line between players and fans.
Right. Well, and it's not that difficult. It's very easy. All you have to say is, yes, we are making money from FanDuel and DraftKings or BetMGM or whatever, but that's for the fans. You're a player. You're a coach. You're a manager. You're not allowed. Sorry, it's very, very simple to me. So I hope Pete Rose does not get in. It's not going to ruin my life if he does, but I don't think he deserves it. I think he ruined his chance.
Do you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the John Rooney Conversation on KMOX, sponsored by Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and if you're a Missourian, we're for you.
The 3-2 pitch in the ninth inning with two outs. A swing, and the ball is popped into short right center field. A long run. Walker makes the catch. That's a Redbird winner. The Cardinals hang on to beat the Phillies 3-2. They've won 9 in a row.
Birds are in good shape right now. As you heard John Rooney say, they've won 9 straight games. They are hoping for 2 games today. We'll get the update from John as he joins us from the ballpark. It is the Cardinals and Phillies, a split doubleheader today. What's going on, John? How's the rain looking?
We have the tarp on the field, but players are out playing catch, and the rain is supposed to get out of here right around game time. So we might have a slight delay, but it appears we're going to get the doubleheader in and have the day off in Kansas City, and then play a really good Kansas City team, come home and play a really good Detroit team. I mean, the stretch of games we're in right now, a great challenge for a Cardinal team that is playing very well.
Yeah, so I want to get to the Cardinals here, but we were just talking, Amy and I, about Rob Manfred, who has basically reinstated guys like Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson for the Hall of Fame, saying that them being on the ineligible list goes away when they die. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't get much into the Hall of Fame. I don't have a vote with it. I think they are Hall of Famers, but you know, that's for a committee and the writers to decide. I have no say in it.
All right, so the Cardinals will have this series, doubleheader today. It's a split doubleheader, and they've played really good baseball. Everything has gone well for them. They've won 9 straight. As you kind of step back and look at them over these last 9 games, what do you think?
Well, I think they're doing everything well. I think they're catching the ball, for one thing. They're playing terrific defense, the outfield defense, like Walker's last play. And somebody commented, he couldn't make that play last year. And one reason, he wouldn't have been out there, for one thing. He would have been replaced by probably Newt Barr slipping over there and Ciani coming in to play. Or if Ciani was already in the game, as he was most of the time, he covered a lot of ground. But I credit Walker. I credit Scott, Newt Barr, all working very hard and diligently with John Jay to improve to the point where they are taking runs away from the opponents and making life a whole lot easier for the starting pitching. The starting pitching has been going deeper. The bullpen is beginning to take shape, and Kyle Leahy has a lot to do with that. Gordon Graceffo hasn't had a lot of work, but what we've seen from him has been spectacular. And it would have been nice to bring up McGreevy to start one of these games today, but he'd be pitching on short rest after throwing over 90 pitches the last time out. He'd be a day short. And so Fetty is getting the start in game one, but There's Steven Matz, who's been stretched out and looked really good his last relief appearance and has looked good as a starter a couple of times. He's ready to go to follow up Fetty today. So it seems like the Cardinals have things in line, and they are believing that when they come to the ballpark, they can win and they will win. I know years ago when the White Sox went into Minnesota, they thought they could beat Minnesota, but Minnesota knew they could beat the White Sox.
Yeah.
There's a difference. Right now, the Cardinals really feel and know that they are in every ballgame and have a chance to win when they come to the park.
Fetty in Game 1, Sonny Gray will pitch in Game 2. And one thing Cardinals starters have done a whole lot better over the last couple of weeks is go deeper into games. It was a problem in the first couple of weeks of the season, putting stress on the bullpen. But, John, they've corrected that. They've done a whole lot better in that area lately.
And the bullpen didn't really respond all that well. Ryan Fernandez just couldn't find his stride that we saw when he started out last year as a Rule 5 pick. I mean, he was spectacular, and I'm counting on him fixing whatever the problem has been and coming back. He hasn't done it yet, but Roycroft has been able to make some adjustments. And talking with him, he said, when you get to this stage, most of the troubles are in your head. It's a mental thing. And he feels like he's overcome some of that, and perhaps Ryan Fernandez has to do the same, because when he's on, he has a really good slider. But we didn't have that early. And then lining up the bullpen with Leahy coming on and getting to Helsley, where he's had a couple of blown saves, but with a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, and he had a wipeout slider the other night when he saved Game 1 here on Monday. All of that added up. We're getting great production out of the catching. Didn't even talk about the catchers. Pedro Páez has done a good job behind the plate. So has Joel Pozo. But they give you good at-bats on top of what they're doing, and they'll eventually ease Herrera back into some catching. But what Herrera's doing as a designated hitter, the man can hit, and when he's done hitting, he goes out and hits some more. That's what's exciting to watch about this team. And Mason Wynn is picking up more confidence as well. It's not the same guy every day. That's what I like about it, and you find that with winning ball clubs.
We talked about this on the Gas House Gang on Monday a little bit, but you know, the Cardinals sweep a team like the Pirates. That's a team you're supposed to beat. They're not particularly good. Now they're playing against Philly. Do games against the Phillies or the Tigers, who are playing really well this year, wins against teams like that, does that matter more to you?
I don't think it matters because of the long schedule, Chris. You have to win today. I don't care who you're playing. And some of those teams, and Mike Shannon used to caution us by saying, look, teams like the Pirates, or at the time the Reds and some of the others, they don't know they're bad yet. And here they are out giving the Cardinals the best possible game they can give them. I mean, the Cardinals dropped 2 out of 3 in Pittsburgh, but they were able to sweep them at home because they were able to get their game in line. But I think the guys, they accept the challenge, but right now they're not really looking at the other team. They're preparing for who they're going to face on the mound that day. And if it happens to be Paul Skeens, it's Paul Skeens. If it happens to be Luzardo in Game 1, Nola in Game 2, they're getting ready for them. And they know who the good teams are. They know that they feel like they can play against those good teams. It's the challenge of going out and getting it done, and they've been doing it lately. I mean, to take 2 out of 3 from the Mets after losing the series opener, and that's where the winning streak started. And then to go into Washington, where the Cardinals have had some trouble in late innings, they were able to put games away, like Sunday's game with 2 in the 7th and 2 in the 8th, to sweep the Washington Nationals. And now here in Philadelphia, to hang on and win a one-run game on the road, I think they're turning the corner as far as road games go and as far as a young team learning how to win. And that has been the fun thing about watching this team grow.
Yeah, John, there were a lot of question marks regarding this team going into the season. And I know players have to play. That's ultimately what it comes down to. But when you do have the option or possibility of moving pieces around, how much credit do you give to manager Ollie Marmol then with some of the success that we're seeing, both with the growth of the players and in the standings?
Well, I'll tell you something Ollie has been able to do is just stay even keel, even when they were losing those close one-run games. They were 0-5 in one-run games right out of the gate, and games that were more than winnable. They've only been out of 2 games, period, of all they've played, and we've played over 40 games now. But Ollie has stayed the same. and he has kept his belief that he likes this roster. But this is a roster, when you look at it, that has major league experience. It's not like they're bringing up the Memphis Redbirds and saying, go get them against the National League and in interleague games. There are guys with playing time. Walker has playing time. Scott has a little bit. Not as much as some others, but Burleson has had some time in the big leagues. So has Gorman, and so has Lars Nootbaar. You go up and down, and last year, a very valuable year for Pajes behind the plate. These aren't guys who are just brand new, but yet they're not battle-tested over 2, 3, 4 years where you really have a great feel for what they can do, and you have to find that out. After all, they thought they were good enough to sign them and bring them in, put them on the roster, and Ollie is using the guys he has on that roster, and right now they're playing well, and it's somebody contributing in a great way differently night in and night out.
All right, as we say goodbye here, John, we got the word not too long ago within the last 10 minutes.
I've got to redo the whole Philly lineup here and all that. I mean, it's a different lineup from the other night because you have a right-hander going instead of Libertor. So I have to kind of rework things here and get that going. So it's I think we're going to get started close to on time. I can't see downtown Philadelphia from the booth here like we can on a nice clear day, where it's a beautiful view from our booth here at Citizens Bank Park. But that is supposed to clear out, and they haven't lifted the tarp yet, but more and more players are out playing catch, getting a little work in. It's cool here in the low 60s and probably won't get much higher than about 62 or 3, and a strong wind blowing out to left field, and that's where a pitcher has to keep the ball down in this little ballpark. So that's what's ahead today.
Yeah, Matt Carpenter announced he's retiring today. But just wanted to get your thoughts on him and his career in St. Louis.
He had a terrific career. Yeah. And when he came up and set a single-season record for doubles, passing Stan Musial, and then he had a power surge there later on, and he had some rough days when he left the Cardinals but came back, made a terrific contribution to the clubhouse, and had some big hits on the field as well. And I thought his leadership was key to some of these young players. Matt Carpenter, good guy, and he'll be wearing one of those red jackets as a Cardinal Hall of Famer sometime in the future.
All right, pregame show is coming up at 11:10 with Tom Ackerman, and this man, John Rooney, is on the call. Ricky Horton
Tell
is there as well.
Tell Tom not to mess it up.
I haven't seen him yet, so I'll let you know when I do.
All right, sounds good. Have a great am I with you on Friday?
You better believe it.
Okay, if I have to.
You have no choice.
All right.
Sorry.
All right.
Bye, John.
Bye. Always good to be with you. Bye.
John Rooney on the call today. 11:10 pregame show with Ackerman. Then the first pitch, 12:05. Game two, we'll have a 4:20 pregame show with Matt Pauly and a 5:15 first pitch. Cardinals and Phillies, a doubleheader in Pennsylvania today. How about that, Amy? You ready to go?
I'm
at least
super ready.
At least 18 hours of baseball today on KMOX. That's what I say. We mentioned it with John Rooney, the radio voice of the Cardinals, just a few moments ago. Today, a Cardinal great. I think we could call him that because he is very likely going to be a Cardinals Hall of Famer someday. Matt Carpenter, who played in 14 seasons in Major League Baseball, has decided to officially call it a career, and talked with Sports Spectrum earlier today, and he made that announcement.
I wanted to take this opportunity on this podcast here with you and officially announce my retirement from the game of baseball. Was very fortunate enough to play for some great organizations, and had quite a thrill being able to don the St. Louis Cardinals logo for many years, a brief stint with the New York Yankees and also the San Diego Padres. And I could thank a lot of people, and I will, but I think I've got to start with my family, my wife Mackenzie. Anybody who's played professional baseball knows that it takes a really strong woman at home to get through what that life looks like. And she was the rock in our household that was able for me to go out and play the game that I loved for so long. And So I can't start without thanking her. And then obviously my parents, my mom, my dad. Having kids now, you realize the sacrifices you make for your own children coming up from the time that they're walking or born. And then, and obviously through youth sports, my dad was my coach, and my love for the game of baseball came from his love of the game of baseball. He pretty much taught me everything that I know about the game. So obviously a huge thank you to them. And yeah, I just wanted to get that out there, and I'm excited for what's next, and getting to spend some much needed quality time with my wife and kids on a more consistent basis now that, you know, you put the cleats up. So yeah, it's exciting stuff.
Matt Carpenter, after 14 seasons in Major League Baseball, has officially announced that he is done in the game of baseball. So it's, you know, it's sad to see a career come to an end, but, you know, he was still playing at 38, mm-hmm. which is, that's ancient. Up there. Yeah, it's ancient for a baseball player, for any professional athlete, to still be going at the age of 38, and he hangs it up. All-star three times. MVP voting, he finished fourth one year, won a Silver Slugger that same year.
Technically a World Series champion, didn't play in the postseason in 2011, but right. did debut with the team that year.
Got a ring. Which is good. Yeah, so it's... And the only...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, I think the only player that I ever really liked that didn't wear batting gloves. I'm always
only
a...
batting gloves?
He didn't wear batting gloves.
He didn't wear... I'm looking at a picture. Oh, my gosh. Doesn't that hurt? Not wearing batting gloves?
I mean, I don't like it.
You don't even play baseball.
I know. I don't like it. I don't like looking at it.
At the batting gloves?
I just wish he would have put some batting gloves on.
Yeah. It does look a little naked now. I never noticed it.
You didn't?
No.
Yeah, that was his thing. Moises Alou did it. I didn't like him, though. He was kind of a
jerk. You think he had really calloused hands?
Had to have.
Because, like, have you ever gone, okay, as a kid, every kid has gone to batting cages. And I didn't play baseball, but went to the batting cages. You always left the batting cages with blisters.
Amy, do you know the thing about Moises Alou?
No.
You don't? Well, he had calluses. And
ew, oh no.
Do you want to know what he said? He said his secret to hardening the skin on his hands.
Ugh.
So that he could hold the baseball bat without gloves.
Yeah.
He went pee-pee on them.
Every day?
I don't know. He said he did it in the shower, and that's how he developed it. Which I think is complete
because the
non-scientific
acid,
nonsense, but that's what he said. Moises Alou is very well known for that. Like, that is his
so
thing.
The acidic bile
I get,
that he peed on his hands every day.
I don't know. That's what he said. And he said it worked. But he is famous for
can
that.
Can you call Matt Carpenter and see if he tried that?
No, we don't need to ask. Well, okay, we could.
I feel like reporting.
I'll tell you what, let's get Carpenter on some point here in the next several days if we can. And I'm going to ask him. I'm going to ask him if he ever did that.
I mean, because honestly, you do. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. If you've ever gone to the batting cages and you're not a baseball player, which I wasn't, I didn't play softball. I would play baseball in the yard, play with mm-hmm. friends. I didn't have batting gloves. I didn't bring batting gloves to the batting cages. To me, not as a baseball player, it was like bringing your own bowling shoes. Who does that?
Well, when I was a kid playing Little League baseball, it was a big deal if you got a pair of batting gloves.
Yeah.
And that was in the 80s when some guys only wore one batting glove. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that time? Where it was just the bottom yeah. hand. The bottom hand would have a batting glove.
Yeah.
And the top hand would be free. And a lot of major leaguers did that too. So when you got a batting glove, it was a cool thing. When you got two batting gloves, oh my God.
Yeah.
You were otherworldly.
You know, Mark McGwire threw his batting glove. I got his batting glove. He threw it to me when I was a kid.
Do you still have it?
No, because I gave it to my friend who brought me to the game.
Let me give you another piece of history.
Okay.
The person who is credited with starting the batting glove thing in Major League Baseball, Hawk Harrelson, who was a player and then the White Sox longtime TV guy. You know, the guy who says, he gone. That guy.
Yeah.
That guy.
Huh.
He took his golf glove And he used it.
Because they look like golf gloves.
That's what he did. And that's where batting gloves started.
Interesting, you know? And now, you can go to a CYC game for fourth graders. They've got sliding mitts. You've never seen kids decked out like CYC games.
Oh, the sliding, the oven mitt looking thing.
The oven mitt looking thing.
I hate those.
It's all about the gear now.
I know. That's one of my old man things. I hate those. I hate the oven mitt. Guys out there with an oven mitt.
It's pretty big.
It is. It looks stupid. I don't like it. Hey, we're going to come back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Are you looking forward to it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Whoa. I want a little more enthusiasm out of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to come back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. But if you missed anything in the abbreviated show that we have done today, you know where to find it on the Audacy app, AUDACY. Might as well download it because you can listen to both Cardinals games today right there from it. You better do that, son. All right, back tomorrow at 9. That's Amy Markscores. I'm Chris Ranji. Cardinals baseball is next. Two games today on KMOX.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Fridman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.